You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Wicker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says learning how to listen can change how you feel about yourself and the world around you.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. The state legislature's budget committee met twice this week and made some big decisions. They rejected the governor's plan to cut tuition at the UW system, and they expanded drug testing for welfare recipients here in Wisconsin.
Jonathan Anderson joins us now. He's a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Stevens Point. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the big state news so far lately is the budget, the ongoing budget deliberations by the Joint Finance Committee. And as we mentioned, that committee rejected Governor Walker's plan to cut tuition in the second year of the budget. Can you talk us through what happened?
Yeah, so what Governor Walker wanted to do was to cut resident tuition at UW schools by 5%, and this would have started in fall of 2018. He had proposed, because of that cut, he had proposed giving campuses $35 million in taxpayer money. But the Joint Finance Committee, which is the state's budget committee, yesterday did something else. It approved a freeze on resident tuition at UW campuses for another 2 years. You might recall that a similar freeze had been put in place in 2013, and this just extends that.
And these are all Republicans, in effect, the governor, Republican, and Republicans in charge of the state legislature and a majority on this budget committee. Were you surprised to see differences between them on this issue?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I think what we have seen lately, it certainly has been noticeable that there have been some differences, sometimes stark differences, between Governor Walker and GOP legislators, not just, of course, on this issue of tuition, but on a whole host of other issues. Transportation is a big issue. Assembly Republicans have proposed increasing the state's gas tax while cutting income taxes, but Walker has said he would veto any increases in taxes on gasoline. It's a similar story with respect to property taxes. Walker has said that he would veto the entire state budget if property taxes go up. And there was even an issue earlier this month when Republican legislators, also on the budget committee, had rejected this idea from Walker to put the state's judicial commission under direct control of the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. And so we have seen these kinds of tussles, noticeably across a whole host of issues. There was also the reporting in April about some fiery text messages between the governor and Robin Voss. I can't say I'm surprised, but it does seem that we're just noticing these things more of late.
Another big story out of the budget committee this week was the expansion of drug testing for people who receive public assistance. What would change if this ultimately goes through?
Right. So what this would do is it would require that certain people, specifically childless adults who have incomes that are at or below the federal poverty level, that those people be screened for illegal drug use before they can participate in Badger Care. This is one of several initiatives that the governor is trying to do to require drug screening for social programs. And ultimately, if it's approved, it could affect nearly 150,000 people in the state.
Is this something that the state can do by itself, or would there need to be some federal sign-off, because this in part would use federal health care money?
Yeah, that's right. There are a few things in play, and one of those is that the federal government would need to approve this drug screening plan, which is really important. It's a big deal because the state would be the first in the nation to have such a requirement.
It's our weekly roundup of Wisconsin news. We have Jonathan Anderson with us, reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Stevens Point. Another big story in Wisconsin this week, a high school teacher in Mount Horeb was put on administrative leave and then taken back off of leave after she showed a documentary called Misrepresentation in Our Class. What happened there, Jonathan?
There was a substitute teacher who was teaching a course on what's called gender inequalities, or I think it's called social issues at the school, and this particular class was on gender inequalities. And they were showing a film which is about how women are depicted in the media, how they are underrepresented in leadership roles in society. And that prompted some complaints from people. What we know is that the complaints weren't against the objective of that lesson itself, but rather about some of the imagery in the documentary and what some felt were they called offensive images of women. They said that those images showed women in humiliating sexual scenarios. Anyway, those complaints led the district to suspend this teacher last Friday, although that suspension was later lifted.
And yeah, I understand Child Protective Services and even the police were notified after complaints were made?
Right. The district did notify local police and the state Child Protective Services Agency, and the superintendent has said that they did that because they believed it was required by state law and school board policy. Although the fact that they did that did raise some ire by parents and even students, some of whom had demonstrated at the school earlier this week in support of the teacher.
So is there talk of the school reviewing policy over what is shown to high school students?
Yes. The superintendent has said that that parents and students would be given the opportunity going forward to skip parts of the course curriculum, and that if anybody does that, they would have to do an alternative assignment.
And finally, Jonathan, it is Memorial Day weekend. A lot of people will be driving around the state, and it looks like this is a fine time to get a speeding ticket. What's the story there?
Yeah, that's right. It turns out that police in Wisconsin write more speeding tickets around Memorial Day weekend right now compared to any other time of the year. And that is according to a Wisconsin State Journal analysis of data from the State Department of Transportation. The newspaper found that more than 9,200 speeding tickets were issued to drivers who are licensed in the state during Memorial Day weekends between 2013 and 2015, compared to any other time period during the year.
And there's a chicken or egg question there. Are they trying harder to enforce then, or is there something about Memorial Day that makes us want to drive faster?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think probably it's, you know, the unofficial start of summer and people are really excited to get, you know, to wherever they're going, especially people maybe headed up north to a cottage by a lake or something like that. I think it's probably people who just want to start their vacation right away.
And Jonathan, do you have a drive in the works for the weekend?
I do indeed. I will be one of those people heading up north in a bit. Yeah.
And I don't want to get too personal here, but do you punch the gas when you're headed out?
Well, you know, I mean, of course, I would never speed, of course, but that would be illegal. But definitely after reading the story, which I thought was really interesting, I will certainly, be driving well below the speed limit.
All right. Play it safe. Jonathan, thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure. Thanks, Rob.
We've been talking to Jonathan Anderson, reporter for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Stevens Point, and he joined us for our weekly recap of some of the top stories in Wisconsin news.
Our next guest says the act of listening is much more than it seems. James Blatchley is a New York-based conductor and the director of the Experiential Orchestra and the Johnstown Symphony Orchestra. And he says listening can change our relationship with ourselves, each other, and the world.
But listening at that level can take some practice. So Blatchley's visiting Wisconsin this weekend to teach the skill at an event called Listening as Leadership. at UW-Madison's Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery on Saturday at 3 p.m.
James, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. I'm thrilled to be here with you.
So as a conductor, you listen for a living. You do a lot of other things, too, but listening is a big part of it. What does it mean to you to listen deeply?
Yeah, when people see a conductor on the stage, they often are reacting to their gestures and to their enthusiasm and excitement and sometimes their hair. You know, Gustavo Dudamel has this very famous hair.
Yeah.
He's an extraordinary conductor. The thing that's harder to articulate or to discern is how important hearing is and listening on the podium. And I find that the great conductors are able to hear not just everything that's going on in the room, but imagine and create a sound world internally that then is reflected by the performance. So it's a fairly ineffable art, but I think we all know it when we hear it. And when a conductor has this expansive inner sound world that becomes reflected in reality in the concert hall or wherever the performance is taking place, and magic happens.
Have you always been able to sort of build a world of sound based on what you feel inside, or has it taken some practice?
It's a constant, it's a constantly evolving process. To become a conductor, people often ask, how did you become a conductor? And I think it's a never-ending process of becoming. And so often the great conductors are those towards the end of their lives. This is when true mastery comes to bear. My pinnacle experience as a conductor and as a listener was attending the Lucerne Festival in 2007 and 9, which is a festival that Claudio Abbado created towards the end of his life. He had already experienced a significant run-in with death, had overcome that, and was in some ways creating music from beyond, from the other side. And that's certainly how it felt to me in the audience. And I was able to listen to every one of the rehearsals, attend each rehearsal, each performance. And the sound world that was created with this orchestra of it's kind of laughable amount of talent on the stage. There were, in the first violin section, there were eight concertmasters from the major European orchestras all playing in the section. So it was this all-star team. And he molded and invited the sound in such an extraordinary way that when I returned to the States, I put on a concert of the exact same piece that he had been conducting, and with that sound still in my body and my ears, I put on my first public performance of Mahler 4. The nature of composing is that you hear music from somehow, somewhere, and then take notes. You take dictation from what you're hearing internally. And when I first met Riccardo Muti, for example, he described how the way to become a conductor is first to be a composer and then observe the great conductors as they work. That's a long answer to a short question, but it's appropriate because I think we become the conductors we want to be over a long period of time.
So to bring that forward into our day-to-day life, when did you realize that the kind of listening that you were doing and also building internally wasn't just something that was going to come into play on an orchestra stage in a great hall somewhere in the world, but in your day-to-day life?
Well, I started to make the connection actually while I was assistant conductor for the Boston Philharmonic, and my role there was many different aspects of many different things, but one of them was taking note internally during performances of all the things that needed to be changed for the next performance, because every player or many players would come to me after the performance and check in with me. How did this sound? Was it too loud today? Could this be better tomorrow? What did you hear? And so I had this long litany of detailed musical notes that I was taking internally in a very cerebral way, it must be said. And the person sitting next to me at one particular performance was listening in the opposite way. She somehow was able in her chair to relax backwards. And if you can imagine someone who loves the sun and hasn't seen it in 10 years, kind of reclining on a beach, absorbing the rays of the sun, this is how she was listening to the performance. And I decided to try that on for size. So I started to relax my body and open physically myself to the sound. And something really shifted internally. And also I heard more. This was also taking place. I was also conducting a lot at the time. And I started experimenting with this on the podium. So when I changed my physical, I would say tension more than anything, or internal awareness of how open I was physically, the sound changed dramatically. And it's something I think many people are aware of, is that the tension in their body is a reflection of the tension in their lives in some way. Often it's trauma is stored in the body in different places. And so we can have tension in the shoulder that is a reflection of perhaps an injury or perhaps something less concrete. But when we're able to open things physically, there are psychological and spiritual aspects that open as well. So I started doing that on the podium, and then a few months later, I was sitting in a garden with a good friend, but a very direct and powerful friend, and she turned to me and said, "James, what is your purpose in life?" And normally, if somebody asks you that question, you kind of deflect it. It's a hard thing to answer on the spot, but I had this flash of insight, and I realized that my purpose in life is to help people listen. And that my training as a conductor and as a composer would all come to bear on that. And I started sharing insights and observations and also creating musical experiences for audiences based around this idea to expand people's ability to listen, not by telling them what to listen for or tell them what they were missing, but rather enabling them, empowering them, honoring what they already were doing, but might perhaps were not as aware of it as they might be. And one way I start this talk at times is to ask the audience to think of a time when they felt heard by someone else, to think of a time when you were going through something difficult in your life and you had a very close friend or a family member who was able to sit with you, and the feeling you have when you feel heard by that person. And it's a physical feeling, and often it doesn't have to do with what that person is saying. It's actually usually when there's no words being exchanged between people that we have this feeling. So we know that feeling well. We know where that sits in the body, and we know that that is can be a transformational experience to have someone sit with you and understand you fully. And so I invite people to use that as a starting point, and then we expand from there. We work on spatial listening, which is also something that we do quite naturally, and people have an incredibly sophisticated ability to listen. And then we work on listening contrapuntally. And ultimately, it all comes back to not only how we listen to each other in a leadership capacity or otherwise in relationships. It's obviously a very helpful skill to develop for marriages. They say that this is one of the key ways that we can measure a successful or a happy marriage is
I want to jump in and explain the word contrapuntally just quickly for people who don't know that musician's term. What is that?
Right. It's the ability to hear several different lines of music at the same time. Often it refers to a melody that's traded from one instrument or voice to another, in the fugue, for example. But if you can hear not only the melody but also the bass line and perhaps one or two inner voices. That's being able to listen contrapuntally. And when one can do that in your own life, for example, we all have an inner dialogue, and often it's an inner monologue, and quite often it's not the most friendly voice that we hear dominating the conversation internally. Mm-hmm. But what we can work on it through this talk and this activity, but also in general when we listen to music or in other ways in life, is to hear not only that dominant voice, but to hear other underlying voices inside of us, underlying presences of perhaps loved ones, beloved teachers, mentors, and supportive voices. So when you can do that, you're not as dominated by these very negative thoughts that we often have about ourselves. You're not doing enough, you're not doing it in the right way, this kind of thing. It's fascinating to hear someone play tennis, for example. You hear their inner voice come out when people talk to themselves, when they miss a shot. People are dominated by that voice very often, and I think that music can heal us in many ways and also transform the way that we listen to ourselves.
James Blatchley is a conductor based in New York. He's the music director of the Experiential Orchestra and the Johnstown Symphony Orchestra, and he's leading a workshop called Listening as Leadership at UW-Madison's Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery on Saturday at 3 p.m.
We go out with Mahler's Fourth Symphony. I can practice my listening skills right now. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
Many large employers use employment tests as part of the process of hiring new workers. While that might not seem at all controversial, there's some evidence that these tests can make it harder for applicants who are women or are from racial and ethnic minorities to get hired.
Will Evans is a reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting, focusing on government oversight. He recently wrote a piece focusing on the use of these employment tests in several states, including Wisconsin. Will, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, your investigation focuses mostly on a kind of test called work keys. Can you tell us about those tests?
Yeah, it's a popular kind of job test where employers will use it to screen job applicants. So you take a test and, you have to pass at a certain level to get the job. Or it can be used as part of what's called the National Career Readiness Certificate, which is popular in Wisconsin. And it's basically a set of three work keys tests. This is like reading and math and other cognitive skills that it's testing. And then employers can use that as a way of filtering job applicants by saying, we require you to have a career readiness certificate at a certain level.
Can you tell us a little bit about the philosophy behind the tests?
Yeah, the idea is that a lot of jobs involve, cognitive skills, and so you can sort of make your hiring process easier by screening out people who might not have the skills to do the job. And so they're trying, a lot of this whole industry is trying to figure out tests that can predict job performance, to try to come up with a gateway that's appropriate for the job that can separate the people who have the skills from the people who don't. The problem is that these tests can also discriminate against women and minorities, and so it's important that they're actually job related, that they're closely tied to the job.
And that seems to be the crux of it. Do these tests actually test for the job at hand, the job that someone might be applying for? How do those things tend to align or not align?
Yeah, that's the crux of it. If you use a test or any kind of hiring practice that ends up screening out more women than men or more minorities than white people, that if that test isn't closely connected to the job, then that could be illegal. It's discriminatory, and so you have to make sure that the test is something that, you know, you're not testing for math skills for a job that doesn't involve any math, for example, because then you're not even getting the right people. Potentially, you're screening out people for no legitimate reason.
And you profiled and interviewed several people who had taken some of these tests who felt that they were unfairly screened out. Can you tell us about some of their experiences taking these types of tests?
Yeah, there's, you know, it's one of those things that's really hard for the individual job seeker to know about. You know, you fail a test, you don't get the job, and you're not going to think initially, you know, this is illegal discrimination. A lot of people only find out when they're contacted later by the federal government because there's some investigation into it. That was the case of one of the people I talked to. She took a test that was for a cheese plant, and it was a laborer job. And she was sitting there taking this test and looking at these questions and thinking, what does this have to do with the job that I want? And she failed. And she didn't think much more of it, but then later got one of these letters saying, look, you know, you're one of hundreds of people who were discriminated against. In another case, I talked to a woman who actually was kind of a special case. She failed a test, didn't get a job, but she knew a lot more than your average job seeker because she used to be a investigator for a civil rights agency and knew the law. And so she filed a lawsuit, and they just won over $1 million.
So you just mentioned a couple of lawsuits that seemed to side with the plaintiffs who were saying they'd been discriminated against. So what has that done to the sort of testing in that industry?
Well, it's interesting because when this happens, when an employer gets in trouble, you know, and I've found cases around the country where employers were found to have used this particular test, work keys, in a way that was illegal and discriminatory. When they get in trouble, they often end up paying settlements that can run hundreds of thousands of dollars. They end up having to scrap the test, hire back some of the rejected applicants. But the test maker, which is in this case ACT, they aren't affected. They're not liable for this. So it's sort of it was initially hard for me to connect the dots. What are all the cases that are connected to this one test? There's actually a bunch around the country. And those employers get in trouble, but the test maker just goes on and keeps marketing the test as a great test for everybody.
We're talking to Will Evans right now, a reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting, focusing on government oversight. And his article about how employment tests can lead to discrimination is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And Will, ACT, as you said, makes these work keys tests that we've been discussing, and they say the problem isn't really with the test. The problem is how the employer might utilize that test. And they're saying, no, you know, this is not a problem with the test. What has that led to so far?
Yeah, that's the argument, is that, and it's true that the test itself isn't illegal. It's how it's used. But these tests are being marketed by the company and also by state officials, including in Wisconsin, as a great test for all kinds of employers to use. And they're saying that employers should be fine if they get this report by an ACT-trained consultant that says which tests you should use for which jobs. But the problem with that is that these cases of discrimination that I found, where companies actually paid big settlements, those companies also got those reports. The government has said over and over again that these these ACT reports are don't hold up. You know, they're not evidence that the test is actually legal. So that's the problem with sort of putting it out there as a great test for all kinds of employers in the state.
And you mentioned in your report that these tests are pretty popular with state governments, for instance, Wisconsin being one. And going back to Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development, they had for a while promoted WorkEase as an employment test and said on the website that it was EEOC compliant. Is that likely to hold up, I mean, legally or in other ways?
Yeah, so that means compliant with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is a big civil rights agency that investigates job discrimination complaints. And that would lead me to think that that using this test in your hiring process is going to be fine with the EEOC. But, you know, I actually ran that by the top testing expert at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. He laughed at the term. He said, you know, not bloody likely, because, you know, it depends on how the test is used. There's not going to be a test that's just going to be fine for any employer to use. You have to be careful because these tests can often lead to different outcomes by race and gender. And so I brought that to the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, and they changed the language, but they said that they weren't concerned that there was, they termed it a handful of cases outside of Wisconsin. They said there were no complaints in the state.
Are we seeing any signs that the way these tests are used or how widespread their use is could be shifting, could be changing?
These are popular tests, and I think, you know, there's more and more tests that come out. There's different kinds of tests, personality tests. This is a burgeoning industry. A lot of employers like using tests because they're cheap and easy. They're straightforward. They feel objective. And they're being told, you know, by state officials, including in Wisconsin, that this will improve your bottom line. It'll save you costs in the hiring process. It'll help you, you know, it's a proven way to find the right people. So that's hard to argue with if you're an employer trying to figure out who to hire.
Will, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Will Evans is a reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting, focusing on government oversight. His article about how employment tests can lead to discrimination is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Memorial Day weekend is the unofficial start of summer for a lot of people, even though it's kind of cold and rainy looking out the window here. But a lot of people are looking forward to vacations in the next few months.
And we want you to tell us about your vacation plans, your past and present favorite vacations at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is your idea of a great vacation, big or small, around the world or around the state? And if money were no object, I know it is really, but if it weren't, where would you really want to go someday? You win the lottery, whatever. If you could choose a getaway to anywhere, where would it be and why? What makes a great vacation? Is it adventure and fun or peace and quiet? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
You can call us 800-642-1234. And music host here at Wisconsin Public Radio, Dan, he says, after moving to Wisconsin, we wanted to go back and visit friends and family in the Lower Peninsula, decided to do the Lake Michigan Circle Tour, and had a wonderful mix of family time, time with old friends, seeing familiar sights and seeing new ones. And our kids were between the ages of 9 and 14. Now they're 23 through 28, and we still talk about that trip, really getting at the magic, the family memories that are created on trips like that.
Yeah, definitely. The road trip, too, is a fun way to do it. And I don't do those enough. I tend to be a get to a destination and then do stuff there and not necessarily, you know, stop and do the cool stuff along the way. Do you do that more?
You know, we've just started to. We've gotten to the age where the kids can sit in the car a little longer without the car exploding. And we did do a trip, much like your trip, actually, to Washington, D.C., only you were on a WPR motor coach
tour.
But we did it in our car. And we did. We stopped at some fun places. We stopped in the southern United States. And I got a taste of some southern food, stayed in a house in the mountains where the road was so steep I thought the car was going to tip over backwards, and there were warnings in the guidebook about rattlesnakes. So yeah, it was an exciting time.
So that car could have tipped over backwards into the nest of rattlesnakes. So I'm glad it didn't come to that.
Thank you.
Well, now you could share your favorite vacation. What are you looking forward to doing this summer? What is a memorable maybe family trip or a trip with friends, or maybe a solo trip? Have you done something like that, taken off by yourself, on the road, in the air, at sea, you name it? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. A usage in my family, vacation versus trip. And this is one my kids came up with some years ago. Vacation is mellow. You go and you chill. Maybe it's sitting on a beach or
you're reading a book,
playing games in a cabin or something like that. Trip is a little more work. You're like seeing the sights and doing stuff and packing the time as best you can.
That's a really good distinction. I think I'm going to take that to heart. That's absolutely true. Trip and vacation.
Do you have a preference?
No, I like them both. Of course, you have to be in the mood for one, and you get in the mindset for one, and then you decide, you know, if you want a more active thing, it's a trip. If you want to chill, it's a vacation.
Yeah, trips sometimes just segue into vacations for me as I get tired. We'll go to our callers now. Tiffany is on the line in Onalaska. Tiffany, hi.
Hey, so I just want to share, we're actually planning our first family vacation. We're headed to the New York area, and I feel like we got a pretty good mix of, like, some educational stuff in there for the kids. But also, you know, like visiting the beach, getting some nice relaxation for the family, and also for the adults, too.
And Tiffany, can I ask, how old are the kids?
My one and only actually just turned 7 today.
A 7-year-old. Aww, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
So you're planning around that 7, so you want a little education in there, but some fun and relaxation, too.
Yeah, perfect family vacation in our eyes.
Tiffany, thanks so much. And I'm a big fan of learning stuff on tour. On that Washington trip you mentioned, hitting various Smithsonian museums and things like that. I have a lot of fun with things like that.
Learning stuff is good, if you can convince the kids. But, well, you know, the Smithsonian museums are spectacular. So, our kids love those too. Well, thank you so much for that call, Tiffany, and have fun. And next we go to Jenny in Delavan. Jenny, hi.
Hi. I am a huge adventurer. All my vacations always, I'm a scheduler too, so those are the ones I kind of go to. But we booked a cruise, and I thought I was going to hate that. And it actually took me about 3 days to learn how to relax, and I had it all scheduled. My husband was like, Jenny, stop. So by like day 3, I ended up having the best time of my life, and I think about that trip all the time and how I learned how to just chill. And
it was
by far my favorite vacation.
Because I think some people think there are cruise people and there are not cruise people, and you're either one or the other, and you think you know what you are, but I guess you're saying maybe you're not so maybe there's an inner cruise person in all of us if we get a chance. So thanks so much, Jenny, for sharing that. And what about you? Do you like going on a cruise? Maybe more of a vacation.
That would definitely, cruise is more of a vacation.
I've never been on a cruise.
I have with my wife's family a couple times. And so the thing about the cruise is, so when I'm on a trip, sometimes I feel guilty if I'm relaxing and not doing all possible stuff while I'm in this place.
That sounds like you.
Yeah, but the cruise, you know, what are you going to do? Jump overboard? You have no choice but to chill and relax.
You will relax.
Yeah, yeah. So I get that. You're a captive audience for relaxation. Thanks a lot for the call, Jenny, at 800-642-1234. We're talking vacations, your favorites, your maybe least favorites, something you want to do, something you would do if money were no object, as we think about vacation headed towards summer, Memorial Day weekend. Again, call in at 800-642-1234. We'll go back to our callers now. Rick is with us in Oma. Rick, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your vacation story?
Well, I've got numerous vacation stories. I started taking vacations when I was about 19 or 20 years old. I figured I'll take my vacations while I'm young enough to enjoy them. So this is one of my more memorable vacations. I was working down in Fort Myers, Florida, and I decided, I think I'll go down to Puerto Rico. So I loaded my my gear, jumped on a plane, flew into Montego Bay, and then I jumped on a public transportation and went down to Negril. And then I walked down the beach and got a little hut about 250 feet off the beach, $250 for the week.
Wow.
And I could look out and see the ocean.
Mm.
I just spent a fabulous week there and just wandered around the island, met a lot of the natives and, the indigenous people, if you will. And it was a great trip.
Well, that sounds fantastic. And is that one of your, you said you've been on a lot, that's one of your top memories?
You know what I just did? I just mixed up Puerto Rico with Jamaica.
Jamaica. Oh, Montego Bay. That should have tipped me off. Yeah.
That's a dead giveaway that I don't know what I'm talking about.
All right. Rick, well, you've had so much fun on vacations. You can't
blurring
even remember
together.
Them all blurring together. Well, that sounds fun, though. That idea of just a little shack on the beach.
Yeah, by the ocean.
Yeah.
That would be fantastic. I don't know if you could get that price these days.
No, it depends on the shack.
Yeah.
And the ocean.
Rick, thanks a lot for that. And let's go to Daniel in Platteville. Daniel, hi.
Hi. I've actually traveled the world for both career and for personal, and one of my favorite is actually going up to Alaska. By going up to Alaska, you could go to all these national parks, you could see the ocean, see something that actually hasn't been really shaped by humans, and actually see a true wilderness. And it's amazing and breathtaking.
Oh, you talk about it beautifully, and you make me want to go even more. That's one I really want to do with my family at some point. I know my mom really wants to see Alaska. Who doesn't want to see Alaska? It's one of those places I think everybody wants to go. But I hope we all get there.
Yeah, it's still on my list. Thank you so much, Daniel, for selling it there. Taking your calls, favorite vacation places, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Matthew joins us next in Sparta. Matthew, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your vacation memory?
Well, it's actually the same vacation. When I was 14 years old, I was fortunate enough to have a mother that took us out to a lot of different places and a dad that grumbly went along with it. we went out to South Dakota, and the best part was, you know, hitting Waldrug, the Badlands, and then eventually Mount Rushmore and Crazy Horse and Custard Park. Well, then when I was a little bit older and had a daughter of my own, I got to take her out when she was 14 and relive that whole thing. And what was really cool is she had the same respect for that whole side of the country that I did. It's a really beautiful area, and it was just remarkable for me.
Matthew, thank you so much. That is a great story, passing it on from generation to generation. Thanks to Matthew. Thanks to everyone who called. And you can still share your vacation memories and hopes and dreams for your travel future. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Yeah, that South Dakota trip is on our family's list, too. So great to hear that you enjoyed it.